shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hello, everyone there. Welcome. Happy New Year to you all. Father Tom Kois here for a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. We are in the year 2024, and as many of us sometimes do, we try to do those once-a-year things, you know, like update your contacts, or not contact lenses, you know, your contacts in your book. I'm trying to throw out even the people that have been called home to God, that I don't need their contact information anymore. Well, as it happens, I was going through some of my saved articles, you know, those things, I got to read that one day. And I didn't get very far because one of the first ones I stumbled on was Alexander Solzhenitsyn's speech at Harvard back in 1978. I was just a young whippersnapper high school, or no, college. I guess I was in college then. And it's got to rank up in that top speeches of the 20th century. And I'd love to share it with you today, though I doubt if I'll do it justice. It's not that long, but it's long enough, and it's got so much content in it that needs commentary and explanation, as it were. We'll see how far we get. Anyways, it's a speech at Harvard, and Harvard was already a bastion of liberal thinking, shall we say. And I was reading a little bit of commentaries. Peter Kreft, who is still alive and still a philosopher, he's a Catholic now. He's a convert. He was there at the speech at Harvard back in 1978, and he points this out, which is a good way to jump into the topic. He said, at the beginning of the speech, he received a standing O. He reserved a nice, long standing ovation. He was already a literary giant. And he wrote about his painful experiences in Russia as kind of the human side of the story, as it were. We had to eat shoe leather, and we froze our fingernails off, fingers and toes off in the Soviet winters and all the rest. And those kind of stories are gripping, no doubt about it. And so people, I guess we like to read about those in the sense of it opens our eyes to the great sufferings going on in the world, what have you. And so his books were well received. He was put in prison. Let me just do a couple of dates here about he and his life. He was a Russian through and through, born there. He served in the army right during World War II. Thank goodness he didn't get killed, as thousands, millions of Russians died, especially fighting Germany on their Western Front, the Eastern Front for Germany. Anyways, but he, after the war, He was put in prison because he expressed some, maybe he was still in the army at the time, maybe, don't know. He expressed in writing to a friend, he didn't publish it. It was letters to a friend that were anti-Stalinist. Well, even letters to a friend get up to the bigwigs, the higher, the brass, as we sometimes say. Anyways, he was thrown in prison for that. I don't know. He was in prison for not that long, I don't think, but long enough, shall we say. He was also thrown out of the writers' union. There was a writers' union, like there are many unions, and obviously the new communist powers that be didn't want their unions to have more unified power over the state than the state wanted to let it have. So that's part of his story. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1971. I was just getting out of grade school back then. And he has this address at Harvard in 1978. So he was exiled from Russia in between in 1974. So he got the Nobel Peace Prize before he was exiled. I guess that certainly contributed to the desire to expel him. Surprised they didn't just outright kill him, right? Somehow he survives. He moved to the United States. You know, so much in the past, I'm going to say 250 years, when people got into trouble in their own land, they moved to the United States. That's the constant story of many of the leaders in Mexico as Mexico is going through their turmoil and problems. If you got too much hot water, you move to the United States. Why? Well, because there is freedom there, freedom of speech and all sorts of other freedom. So you can hide there. We accept everyone. So in many ways we did. And then many times people went back to their lands to fight the good fight, you would say, certainly in Mexico and in Russia here, and with our hero, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So anyways, he died back in Russia. He died in 2008, huh? Not that long ago. He was 89 years old, and he was buried in a cemetery plot that he chose, he picked out at a monastery, which shows his strong faith, right? And that's a huge part of who he is, and it's a huge part of the speech he gives at Harvard, which is a great bit of the reason why, as Peter Kreff noted, at the beginning of the speech, he receives a standing ovation, but at the end, it was more polite applause. And many of the Harvard ilk, Harvard's in the news these days here in 2024 because Harvard, the president of Harvard just resigned over the controversy, two controversies, one because a number of people were discovering a bunch of plagiarism in her writing. Another was because she, when there were pro-Palestinian marches and pro, Israeli anti-Israel marches going on, a lot of the Jewish people at Jewish students, and I'm sure even some teachers, felt nervous, felt unsafe. And of course, in a university setting, feeling safe is their ultimate mission. We will help keep you safe. And that usually meant keep you away from opinions that you don't agree with. But here, the Jewish people were not feeling safe because the pro-Palestinian fighters, defenders, were threatening Jewish students even with violence and perhaps even murder, I suppose. And anyway, so the present president of Harvard was not able to accept any criticism She was adamant about this concept of keeping people safe, and she says, well, it all depends on the context. And as people pressed her, she couldn't make herself say that the threats to the Jewish people, the Jewish students, were in opposition to their university policies, as it were. Anyways, so that's why Harvard is in the news today. But back in 1978, and of course 1978 was before the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? So Alexander Solzhenitsyn is here speaking to the elites of Harvard University, and he has a tremendous challenge for the people of the Harvard liberal elites, shall we say, and it should challenge all folk of goodwill today. I can help if you can follow me. I'll try to read select passages here. I do think what you need to keep in mind as he speaks back in the 70s, which is, let's face it, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, it depends on. He would be, you keep in mind the controversies that even President Trump is going through, the controversies of the censorship of people with a more traditional conservative viewpoint are going through, the fake news issue, how the press is treating issues of the day and people of the day. So anyways, Alexander Solzhenitsyn could have very well delivered almost the same speech word for word at Harvard today. He probably wouldn't have got the standing O at the beginning, and he might have gotten booed off before he had a chance to finish it today. So we'll start off with them as he starts off in his speech. He says, Harvard's motto is Veritas. Of course, he's speaking. I learned that he delivered this speech. He himself was speaking in Russian, but it was a translated in English over the loudspeaker, so it must have been an interesting little scene. But anyways, he notes right at the beginning, Harvard's motto is Veritas, the Latin word for truth, right? And right away, we might suspect some trouble a brew if he's going to point that out. That's a word like Dennis Prager on the radio often says, truth is not a left-wing value. Truth doesn't matter to anyone who's going to be interested in truth is not going to pursue or be friends with or follow the radical left-wing philosophies, as it were. So he says, and Solzhenitsyn continues, many of you have already found out, and others will find out in the course of their lives, that truth eludes us if we do not concentrate our attention totally on its pursuit. Truth will elude you if it's not a real important value and you really want to get to the truth. That's why I got to add this here. Many people, when I talk who are interested in theology and consider becoming Catholic, especially those who are of the Christian worldview, love Christ, accept the Bible in a lot of different ways, if you pursue a question and you pursue it diligently, you end up becoming Catholic, which is, in a real sense, a beautiful thing. You know, it happened with Scott Hahn when one of his students asked him, Professor Hahn, where in the Bible does it teach sola scriptura? Where in the Bible is it taught that the Bible is the only source of authority? And he couldn't answer that question very well, and he went home and he tried to answer it for himself, and pursuing that question, pursuing the true answer to that question, led him to become Catholic, among other things. I'd like to say, too, that his appreciation, his growing appreciation of the teaching on artificial contraception in Humanae Vitae also brought him to Catholicism. So there's this doctrinal sense of who God is and what the Church is, as well as what's the right way to live and what are the right and wrong things, what are virtues, what are sins. And it goes back here. Let's go back to Solzhenitsyn from 1978. But even while truth eludes us, the illusion of knowing truth still lingers and leads to many misunderstandings. Also, truth is seldom pleasant. It is almost invariably bitter. There is some bitterness in my speech today, too, but I want to stress that it comes not from an adversary, but from a friend. Goodness, isn't that a significant intro? If he's going to share some challenging thoughts, he wants to say, I'm a friend of you, the USA, and the whole Western world. I come from Russia, sort of from the East, but here I am now in the West. I had to escape Russia. Now living in the United States with his wife, and I think he had three children. Not sure if his three children came to him with the United States. I think they stayed in Russia. Not sure. We'll figure that out. Anyways, so he's saying, I'm going to have some critical things to say, but I want you to know that it comes to you as a friend. That leads me. I got to share with you one of the little lines that I used on several of my Christmas and New Year's Day sermons. And I think I've said it here on the Winds of Change radio before, and I'll say it again until the cows come home. And that is, just because I disagree with you doesn't mean I don't love you. That's kind of what Solzhenitsyn is saying here. I got to be critical of what's going on here in the world today, but I'm critical as a friend. If that attitude were taken a little bit more seriously, would some of these priests who are critical of the Church today be canceled? You know, if you take what is being said and either if it's valid, you say, thank you for correcting me. If it's not valid, you correct them and you stand up for your understanding of the truth, and you try to help the other person come to the truth, because if you both come to the truth, you'll be united, as it were. So anyways, okay, that's a little bit of the introduction of this important world-changing speech that we need to refresh our minds with here. And those especially who have any inkling to the communist way to solve our problems today, but also to the secular way of trying to solve our problems today. What that means, I think Solzhenitsyn puts his finger on it. Anyways, let's take our first break. Okay, there, Armand, we'll take our first break here. I am Father Tom Kois. Thank you for listening to The Winds of Change. We'll be right back after these messages.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule? Work? Or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
I'm Father Tom Kois, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Welcome to a St. Nicholas Minute. How did St. Nicholas become the patron saint of sailors? Well, when I was a young man, I made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, visiting all the holy sites, including the humble cave in Bethlehem. During our return voyage from the Mediterranean seaport of Caesarea, a sudden, violent storm threatened the lives of everyone on board, reminding the passengers and crew how Jesus once calmed the Sea of Galilee. I invited everyone to join me in prayer to the Lord. Then, miraculously, the sea became calm. After our safe return, people started asking me to pray with them for a safe voyage. And so, that's how I became the patron saint of sailors, as well as the special friend of children during this joyous season, when we proclaim, Christ is born, glorify him.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyce here on a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. I'm trying to bring to your attention one of the great speeches of the 20th century, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's speech at Harvard back in 1978. He goes on. He says, the split in today's world is perceptible even to a hasty glance. Any of our contemporaries readily identifies two world powers. Of course, he's thinking of the United States and Russia, but you can also expand the idea of the United States to Western civilization, as it often is. Now, that's not an exact identification, because the other side of Western civilization besides the United States are the nations of Europe, and there's a rift between Europe European Western civilization and American Western civilization too. But in comparing them to the East and what was happening with communist Russia, you can put them both together, he says. So he says, the truth is that this split is much more profound and a more alienating one, since those rifts are more than one can see at first glance. This deep manifold split bears the danger of manifold disaster for all of us. In accordance with the ancient truth that a kingdom, in this case, our earth, divided against itself, cannot stand. How can you not think about applying to what he's saying to our world today? It is still split, still majorly split. And this is what he's saying there is kind of the reason why I feel it's worth studying philosophy and theology. And a lot of people don't study philosophy and theology primarily, first, because they don't have enough time for it, because they have to study other things that are related directly to their job one way or another. If you're an architect, you got to keep up with architecture. If you're a rocket scientist, you got to keep up with the technology of science, rocket science. If you're a doctor, medicine, et cetera, et cetera. But he's pointing out something quite significant, and that is if you don't think deeply about it, your casual understanding of the divisions in the world and society today are not going to really get to the essence. And that, I think that's a darn good bit of advice for even families, right? There's rifts in the families. If you don't care about political division, you darn better well care about family division. And if you don't think philosophically and theologically in terms of divisions amongst family members, then you're not going to get to the essence of it either. Family divisions are similar to world divisions between cultures by virtue of theology and philosophy. It seems obvious to me, but don't know if it's obvious to you or not. I think it should be, right? Okay. So then, of course, he's using the words of our Lord, a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. Remember, Jesus used those words when the scribes and Pharisees accused him of casting out demons through the power of the demons. And Jesus rightly reminds people, how could Satan's kingdom stand if it's divided amongst itself? A lot of us are worried about the unity and the future of our precious country.
Wow.
Indeed.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
And the idea that Satan won't destroy Satan, or an evil spirit won't conquer the evil spirits. Evil likes chaos. And if your goal is chaos, then chaos will... Chaos is easier to bring about than peace and harmony, right? So on the family front, if your goal is just to cause chaos, you can certainly do that. Just like some of these movements today. And it is part of what inspired and what led Joseph Stalin in his communist revolution. First, you got to create chaos to tear down what exists so that you can build something new on the rubble of what has been torn down. So that's almost always the case of a revolution. And the Catholicism gives a different twist to revolutions. The main revolution was the incarnation. And our Lord did in some way tear down what existed when you talk in terms of paganism. But ever since Christ, as the church tries to grow and go through the difficult centuries of its life, it always resisted the revolution that chooses to destroy everything so that something new can be built on it. It's always better to correct and reform. And so it is much better to speak in terms of reforming what we have rather than destroying and doing a real revolution. Are some revolutions authentic? Are they justified? You could read the beginning part of Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, and you could see when in the course of human events it becomes necessary to separate yourself from a tyranny or a power that won't allow you the freedom to exercise basic human rights, then it becomes necessary to separate yourself from that power. So I do accept the American Revolution as a legitimate revolution. However, bringing back theology could have done better to reform and correct. Catholicism wasn't as strong as it could have been, should have been. And Catholicism had become very weak after the Protestant Reformation, Protestant Revolution, as it were. Okay, so let's go on with Solzhenitsyn, because he's going to get back into his Russian experience. He says, for 1,000 years, Russia belonged to a category in the world's community of nations. As it were, many cultures existed sort of separate but equal, you might want to say, if you use another phrase, autonomous cultures, he says. There were a lot of autonomous cultures, and Russia was one of those autonomous cultures. And then here's where he starts zinging the Western thinking, American thinking. Although Western thinking systematically committed the mistake of denying Russia's autonomous character, and therefore it never really understood Russia. Just as today the West, or the United States, does not understand Russia in communist captivity. Now there's a mouthful, right? Those those of us who, you know, history goes back. Russia has a history that's longer and more ancient than the Russia of communism, communist Russia. It was the land of the Orthodox Russian Christian faith, of course. And there certainly could be a number of things we could point to. Again, putting on our philosophers' hats and our theologians' hats, we can decipher and pursue truth to see what is the fullness of the truth. The division between Eastern Orthodox Christianity and Eastern Orthodox Catholicism. There is Orthodox Catholicism and there's Protestant Orthodox Christianity. Anyways, it's a complicated mess and takes a lot of love of the pursuit of truth to get to all these things, right? So now he goes into he's sort of criticizing the people for just seeing Russia as the evil empire, to quote Ronald Reagan's phrase, and in a lot of ways that helped advance Russia, of course, right? I think even Ronald Reagan would have appreciated what Solzhenitsyn said by appreciating Russia under communist captivity. By calling Russia the evil empire, he wanted to separate communism from the Russian Christianity or a Christian Russian culture. So I don't think what Solzhenitsyn's saying here is going against the hard line, shall we say, of Ronald Reagan, because Ronald Reagan did see Russia should be liberated from communism, not from Russia, as it were. So that's a beautiful, let's see, let's go on here a little bit farther. How short a time ago, again, quoting Alexander, relatively the small new European world was easily seizing colonies everywhere. Not a relatively small European world. When you look geographically, you could see that Europe isn't the biggest part of real estate on the globe, but it was certainly the dominant part. They were seizing colonies everywhere, not only without anticipating any real resistance. You send your army, you send your people, go take this land. Okay, we'll do it. And obviously there was some resistance, but not unmanageable. But also, well, tell that to Cortez when he was trying to free the Indians of Mexico from the Aztec and Mayan slave, pagan slave drivers. And he fought very, very hard. And he knew there was great resistance. Anyways, since I brought it up, I got to throw this. I always have the impression that it was Cortez who went against all of the Indian tribes, the small group of Europeans against the amazingly numerous Indian tribes of Mexico. It wasn't that at all. It was true that Cortez from Spain, trying to bring Christianity and conquer Mexico, had a small group of Europeans, but his army quickly grew because there were so many Indian tribes who were telling them, "We can you help us defeat the Mayans? they come and steal people and then kill them in their ritual sacrifices, what have you, right?" Okay, let's take our next break here now, and we'll continue a little bit more with Solzhenitsyn. As I said, this is a long speech, and there's a lot to digest. But we'll start analyzing it, and I hope it will wrinkle your brain and help you understand what's going on today in today's world as well. Anyways, thanks for listening to The Winds of Change. I'm Father Tom Coyce.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Koska Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org. to find out how.
And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air, what with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air, live, Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststanschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button. For Winds of Change podcasts, click on Listen to Episodes or visit the Winds of Change Facebook page.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for tuning in with the Winds of Change here. Father Tom Coyce here. I'm sharing some thoughts on Alexander's 1978 speech at Harvard. And he's sitting in front of a crowd that was probably, they're the older brothers and sisters or mothers and fathers of the Harvard crowd of today, but they are the reason why the Harvard crowd of today is the way they are, with its, shall we say, strong liberal bent. And as Peter Kreft said, as the speech went on, a lot of the liberals in the crowd started getting antsy. It sounds like he's criticizing some of the very things that we believe in so very, very strongly. Anyway, there's one section of his speech where Peter Kreft says, as he's looking around, people were starting to smile again because it was criticism of the West. He goes like this. He says, There were no geographic frontiers or limits to this colonization. Western society expanded in a triumph of human independence and power. And all of a sudden in the 20th century came the discovery of its fragility. We now see that the conquests proved to be short-lived and precarious, and this in turn points to defects in the Western view of the world, which led to these conquests. Relations with the former colonial world now have turned into their opposite, and the Western world often goes to extremes of subservience. But it is difficult yet to estimate the total size of the bill which former colonial countries will present to the West, and it is difficult to predict whether the surrender not only of its last colonies but of everything it owns will be sufficient for the West to foot the bill. So the Harvard crowd was starting to smile because they're criticizing the imperialistic style of America. Of course, it wasn't just America. Britain had colonies, and France had colonies, and Italy had colonies, and Germany, in some sense. Especially that criticism of the United States and its colonial spirit, which is very, very much a part of any young person's college education. How the heck could we have enslaved and been so badly treating the Indians, the Japanese, the Mexicans, anywhere we would try to colonize? And so they were happy that Solzhenitsyn was appreciating this negative side of Western culture. But their smiles didn't last too long because he's going to correct, he's going to give a better understanding of the, well, the worldview, let's say. Okay, so he says, but the blindness of superiority continues in spite of all and upholds the belief that the vast regions everywhere on our planet should develop and mature to the level of present-day Western systems, which in theory are the best and in practice the most attractive. There is this belief that all those other worlds are only being temporarily prevented by wicked governments or by heavy crises or by their own barbarity from taking the way of Western pluralistic democracy and from adopting the Western way of life. Countries are judged on their merit of their progress in this direction. So they'd still be smiling with that because the modern day criticism of the American colonial spirit is that we want everyone to be just like us. And in truth, what he's saying is true because a lot of people do want to come here. It doesn't seem like there's any other country on the globe where people want to go. Even Solzhenitsyn had to admit he had to go to the United States to find a better life, as it were. So, so in the sense that it has this kind of freedom that is either lacking in other places or not as there may be freedom in other places, but not as much prosperity. So you get the two here, and so you want to come here. So move down here a little bit more on his speech. He's going to try to throw a curveball at us Westerners here. And it's not so much a curveball if you're a religious believer, especially if you're a Catholic with a traditional religious outlook. He's going to say something that will make us smile and make the Harvard professor cringe a little bit more. Because he says this, however, it is a conception which develops out of Western incomprehension of the essence of other worlds, out of the mistake of measuring them all with a Western yardstick. That would make the Harvard folks smile because they're committed to the idea that truth is relative. So if we have any truth here, we just got to pretend it doesn't exist anywhere. Let them find their own truth. That's how they might respond to that. The real picture of our planet's development is quite different, and which about our divided world gave birth to the theory of convergence between leading Western countries and the Soviet Union. It is a soothing theory which overlooks the fact that these worlds are not at all developing into similarity. Neither one can be transformed into the other without the use of violence. Besides, convergence inevitably means acceptance of the other side's defects as well. And this is hardly desirable. So you can see, if we think of, again, we're meditating on this speech after the downfall of Soviet Union and a new Russia comes. Now, some people, I sometimes get the feeling like our president today, by using the fight between Russia and Ukraine, he's got the evil empire picture of Russia that used to exist in everyone's mind, but that evil empire of Russia isn't exactly the same. Not that it's completely converted, as it were, but it's not the same. So I want to think of if we praise the efforts of one like President Reagan, who helped topple the Soviet Union, with the help of John Paul II, I might add. But if we think that that success of the Reagan Catholic downfall of Russia, if we think of that as successful without the religious component, then it's not a success at all. In other words, to think that it was only the spirit of a Western Republican form of government, or even democracy, if you will, Western political thought is what Russia needed. And we don't keep in mind how important the Catholic, the Christian component was, then it really wasn't such a success. But one of the smartest things I think Reagan did was reach out to John Paul II. Reagan did recognize it wasn't just a political battle, it was a spiritual battle in a very real way. So let's take our final break here, and we'll see if we can get a little bit farther in this wonderful talk. Peter Kreft calls it the one of the greatest speeches of the 20th century. So that's why I'm taking my time and going almost paragraph by paragraph here, my friends. So we'll be right back, okay? Thanks for listening to The Winds of Change. I am Father Tom Coyes.
Sometimes it's tough to hear Winds of Change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air, live, Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button. For Winds of Change podcasts, click on Listen to Episodes or visit the Winds of Change Facebook page.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
Welcome to a St. Nicholas Minute. What is a saint anyway? Although I was imprisoned for 7 years during a terrible persecution of the church under the pagan Roman Emperor Diocletian, I'm one of the first saints honored not because I suffered a bloody martyrdom like St. Peter or St. Paul. I was called a saint because people began to say, Nicholas loves Jesus so much that you can see a lot of Jesus in him. And that's what a saint is, someone who wants to become more and more like Jesus, who is the light of the world each and every day of our lives. One day when a class of parochial school students were in church, their pastor asked the assembly of children, what is a saint? Then a first grade girl pointed up to a stained glass image of a saint saying, saints are those people who let the light in. And so as we celebrate the birth of Christ, let your light shine before others that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Christ is born. Glorify him.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyes here. This is the Winds of Change radio station of beautiful Greater Chicagoland. Here's another jab that Solzhenitsyn has to us Western thinkers. Those Western thinkers who don't have a strong conservative, traditionally minded theology and philosophy behind their outlook on life, shall we say, because it's not a jab to us as it is to the professors of Harvard, we'll say. So he says this, a decline in courage may be the most striking feature which an outside observer notices in the West in our days. Decline in courage. Certainly, he's not referring to the fact that it was the United States that sent troops to the shores of France on D-Day, that kind of courage, or the courage that United States showed in those Navy pilots that won the Battle of Midway, or any of the other things that we could come up with. There's certainly a lot of courage there. But remember, this was in the 70s, and I think he's kind of thinking of the Vietnam War. As a matter of fact, he does touch on the Vietnam War there, but the decline in courage that was exhibited by the United States in allowing communism to just have its way, shall we say, the decline in courage. So he says this: the Western world has lost its civil courage, both as a whole and separately, in each country, each government, each political party, and of course, in the United Nations. Such a decline in courage is particularly noticeable among the ruling groups and the intellectual elite, causing an impression of loss of courage by the entire society. It's interesting he points out the United Nations, isn't it? The United Nations, maybe that's the key. Remember, the United States was created primarily by our American President Woodrow Wilson after World War I to try to prevent no other wars. We will discuss everything before pulling out the weapons. It's a good idea, but without the courage to pursue the truth deeply or unfailingly, then that strategy isn't going to work. And that's certainly a good representation of the way the United Nations works today. He goes on. The political and intellectual bureaucrats showed depression, passivity, and perplexity in their actions and in their statements, and even more so in theoretical reflections to explain how realistic, reasonable, as well as intellectually and even morally worn it is to base state policies on weakness and cowardice. The decline in courage is ironically emphasized by occasional explosions of anger and inflexibility on the part of the same bureaucrats when dealing with weak governments and with countries not supported by anyone or with currents which cannot offer any resistance. But they get tongue-tied and paralyzed when they deal with powerful governments and threatening forces, with aggressors and international terrorists. Should one point out that from ancient times, declining courage has been considered the beginning of the end? I could just imagine some of the more liberal elites who tend to be pacifists when it comes to international conflicts, they'd feel that he's shooting arrows at them, right? The dove and the hawk, he's definitely shooting his arrows at the doves. Let me go down a little farther here. Let's see. Okay. Now this is, I'm going to stop here for a minute. We only got a few minutes left, but I got to make reference to another book I'm reading. As a matter of fact, some people from our little Sag Bridge Mission Society, you might know the Sag Bridge Mission Society, for we've run a number of interesting talks and guest speakers and what have you. We advertise sometimes on another radio station, WIND. They, by the way, we'll have more radio spots for the Sag Bridge Mission Society coming here, because we were able to make a donation by a wonderful donor, a wonderful friend of mine. Actually, she's my sister. She made the $2,500 donation to the Food for the Poor, and therefore we get radio spots on WIND. So listen up, any of you who listen to other stations besides the Winds of Change, which I suppose there are a few of you anyways. Anyways, the Society just bought and passed out a very interesting book called The Popes Against Modern Heirs. The Popes Against Modern Heirs. And I just want to read you a little something from Pope, Pius IX. And this was back in the Civil War days, 1864. Of course, he wasn't in the Civil War in Europe. It was a civil war in the United States. But anyways, there was lots of wars going on. It's a very tumultuous time in Europe, as well as America. And one of the criticisms that Pope Pius IX makes in this encyclical called On Current Errors. On Current Errors. It's reminiscent. There's an eerie similarity of the way Solzhenitsyn is criticizing America as well. And notice, again, I'll repeat, it's a criticism of America, but it doesn't hurt my heart because I could love this country and be critical of it, and I see the answer lies from above in the truth of our faith. Add more Catholicism to the ingredients, and we'll bake a beautiful cake in the end. But here's what Pope Pius IX said back in 1864. For you well know, venerable brethren, he's talking to the bishops of the world, that at this time men are not found, not a few, who applying to civil society an impious and absurd principle of naturalism, as they call it. I should laugh at the way he uses these fighting words. Impious and absurd principle. I don't even know if you can get away with such negativity, right? They dare to teach that the best constitution of public society and also civil progress altogether require that human society be conducted and governed without regard being had to religion, any more than if it did not exist, or at least without any distinction being made between the true religion and the false ones. And against the doctrine of Scripture, of the Church, and of the Holy Fathers, they do not hesitate to assert that is the best condition of civil society in which no duty is recognized as attached to the civil power of restraining by enacting penalties offenders against the Catholic religion, except so far as public peace may require, for which totally false ideas of social government they do not fear to foster that erroneous opinion, most fatal in its effects on the Catholic Church and the salvation of souls, called by our predecessor, Gregory XVI, an insanity, that liberty of conscience and liberty of worship is each man's personal right, which ought to be legally proclaimed and asserted in every rightly constituted society, and that a right resides in the citizens to an absurd liberty which should be restrained by no authority, whether ecclesial or civil, whereby they may be able openly and publicly to manifest and declare any of their ideas whatever. That's kind of what Solzhenitsyn is gonna try to say. We can't have this absolute liberty without that internal restraint that comes mostly from a life lived in pursuit of God, in pursuit of the truth. There's an internal restraint that Solzhenitsyn gets to. Well, hopefully I'll have another chance to go a little bit farther into this in the weeks to come. I'm Father Tom Coyce. You've been listening to The Winds of Change. God bless you.
Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The